From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start the hour with the question in Washington at the moment. Will a short-term spending plan that Republican leaders in the House drafted last night have the votes to avert a government shutdown on Friday night? The plan is sweetened for balking House conservatives with more money for the military. There's also funding for CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. That's big with Democrats. But will they be lured by that or hold out because the plan does not include a deal for Dreamers, the young people brought to this country illegally? This morning, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan seized on the bind Democrats are in.
It is just unconscionable to me that they would block funding for our military or cut off funding for these states that really will lose their funding for CHIP by playing these political games and tying them to unrelated issues.
But the chair of the House Freedom Caucus says Ryan doesn't have the votes to pass the measure right now. It's also not clear if the Senate has the votes to pass it. Our Here and Now political analysts join us. Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. And John Brabender, Republican strategist. Hi, John.
Hello. Good to hear you.
And what's your guess, John? Do you think they're going to be able to avoid a shutdown on Friday?
I do. I don't think it's in the interest of probably either parties to have that happen. I think particularly on the Republican side, I think that if they can get the Freedom Caucus to just move a little bit, the deal is almost there. I think that they wouldn't mind putting the Democrats in a position that they oppose the continuation of the CHIP program, but still pass it and keep the government going. And I think Ryan makes a pretty compelling argument when he says, why are we going to end a lot of the funding for things that we really need while we're holding up the whole thing hostage over some of the immigration reforms that we still have time to deal
with? Well, Jamal, what about that? You know, should Democrats reject this bill and be labeled as the people who didn't fund CHIP, but also be blamed for a government shutdown the way Republicans traditionally have in the past? You think, you know, Ted Cruz or Newt Gingrich?
Let's just remember that the Republican Party controls the House, the Senate, and the White House. They have majorities in all three of those places. They have the ability to pass whatever bill it is that they want. So this is not necessarily about what Democrats support and what Democrats don't. This is about what the Republican majority can do. And if they don't pass a bill and they don't fund the government, then there'll be a government shutdown. That has very little to do with Democrats. They ram through this bill on the tax reform without Democratic votes. They can do whatever it is they want.
Well, this is a different – I mean, they do need Democrats, don't they?
One would think they need Democrats if they would get rid of the badly named Hastert rule. They ought to be able to pass things by the will of the House, but that's not what they do. They get a majority of the majority for the priorities of the president and the speaker. This is not a Democratic problem. This is a Republican problem.
But let's be clear about this. What we've really done is we've taken one side of the aisle, the Democrat Party, and said that we're just going to vote against everything. We're going to obstruct everything. And that forces us to have a legislation or all legislation be passed by one party only through basically a unanimous vote, particularly in the Senate. And I think that's you know, certainly is symbolic of what the Democrats have decided.
Isn't that exactly what your party just did, though? Isn't that just what your party did during the entire Obama presidency, is vote against everything?
But look, what this has really done, number one, is made this about the 2018 elections and the 2020 elections rather than about legislation. Number two is I would agree that what has happened in Washington on both sides is that we have changed this to basically legislation by proclamation or executive order by the president too often, and not enough by bipartisanship. And I think both parties do deserve a certain amount of criticism from that. And I think it did handicap President Obama, and I think presently it's handicapping President Trump, and I think that's unfortunate for America.
Well, let's remember the Obama White House did reach out to Republicans to try to pass some of the big bills, but Republicans refused to play along because, as Mitch McConnell said when he got elected, their objective was to make Barack Obama one-term president. So they refused to play along with any of the legislative initiatives that the White House is putting forward. But let's go to today. Today, which the Democrats have not had, you know, only had for the first 2 years of the Obama administration, today the Republicans control the White House, the House, and the Senate. They can pass any bill that they want, and they cannot pass the blame off to Democrats.
Well, we did just give a tax cut to about 80% of the taxpayers in America. And
you'll take the blame for that.
So believe me, I'm more than happy to watch the Democrats run ads in 2018 saying that I opposed the tax cuts. Reelect me. But here's the other thing, too. You know, if the Democrats' argument is, well, you know what? You did this to us. Now we're going to do this to you. How does that make the Democrats any better than the Republicans who did that? This shows the childish nature of why people are fed up with Washington in general. And frankly, that is this sort of culture that led to Donald Trump being elected.
Well, meanwhile,
just can't pick and choose. If they wanted to have a comprehensive immigration reform, if they put a bill on the floor for DACA and comprehensive immigration reform, including H-1B visas and a whole bunch of other things, that bill would pass. They won't do it because they want to get the majority of Republicans.
So what
they
happens
pick and choose
what happens to those votes. Dreamers then, Jamal? What is the next step that's only got until March to figure this out?
I think they'll figure it out because everybody in the majority of the country supports this, including the majority of Republicans. What is happening is a small minority of Republicans, including the president and his right-wing allies inside the White House, like Stephen Miller and apparently the chief of staff, believe that this is not something that's worth doing. We have got to have the majority of the country's will expounded on this, and Democrats are going to push for the best leverage to get that done.
So that's the Dreamers. But let's just for a second, John, let's talk about the comprehensive immigration deal. On the Senate floor today, Democratic leader Chuck Schumer said President Trump should stop being the only person blocking the bipartisan compromise bill. I mean, the president did say on one day in front of TV cameras, you bring it to me and I'll accept it. They brought it. And he not only didn't accept it, he reportedly used some foul language. This is the bill that Senators Lindsey Graham and Dick Durbin negotiated last week. Let's listen to Schumer.
So I have a challenge for President Trump. Everyone is talking about how bigoted your comments were last week. Well, actions speak louder than words.
John, your thoughts on what happened with that bipartisan compromise bill?
Well, I think there's two parts of this. First of all, bipartisan doesn't mean just one Republican and one Democrat. There still has to be some consensus. And there was not consensus among the Republicans much beyond Lindsey Graham. And so that was problem number one. Number two is, and I truly believe that the Democrats are not totally sincere in trying to negotiate something. The fact that they repeatedly just want to go back and talk about the rhetoric that the president used rather than talk about the legislation, I think that that shows their hands. And number three is, bipartisanship means also taking a look at things like the president wants, building the wall and other security measures. But the only things the Democrats really seem, you know, that they want to talk about are their side of the equation and not look at this contextually from working Americans who are here legally, but looking at it from people here who aren't here necessarily legally. And I think you have to look at it holistically and on both sides.
Well, you know, John's reference to the bipartisan bill that came from Senator Lindsey Graham, who is no, moderate. He might be rational, but he's no moderate conservative. Lindsey Graham and Durbin came up with a bill, Senator Dick Durbin, the Democrat, came up with a bill that had a bunch of the features he just mentioned. The problem is the president's right-wing allies won't allow that bill to go to the floor and the president to sign it. I'm not sure why that's the case, but that's where we are. And it's the reason why we're stuck.
Well, I do think you have to remember one thing, that a big part of why Donald Trump was elected was that the 2016 election was very much a referendum on who do the American people support when it comes to immigration reform. And they had two completely opposing views between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and they chose Donald Trump. And so I think lost in all this is what the American people are saying.
A minority of the American people.
Well, okay. Under our elected session,
let's not overplay the hand. 3 million more Americans voted for an alternative
vision. But if you look
vision.
At the Electoral College votes, the way our system is set up in looking at
you
a referendum
can't say
the
majority
between the
of
two.
Americans.
Well, okay. A majority
yes.
of
okay.
the Electoral College voters.
We've got news from Wisconsin. We've got news from Wisconsin that I want to get to very briefly here. There was a special election for a state Senate seat, and the Democrat won, and the anti-Trump conservative commentator Charlie Sykes from Wisconsin says this was a genuinely stunning setback for the GOP there. Here's the winner, Patty Shackner.
This isn't really about me. It's about us and our life here in Western Wisconsin and us standing up and really having a voice for us and our families in education, in the environment, in health care, in addiction, mental health.
John, Trump won this district by 17 points. What do you make of this?
Well, look, I think it is significant. In fact, I think Governor Scott Walker made the point that this should be a wake-up call to Republicans in Wisconsin as well. And the one thing I've learned in the political space, you have to be realist. And we have to understand that Republicans have done a relatively ineffective job of explaining a lot of the things that we've accomplished in Washington and around these some of these states. And we need to do a better job at that, and we better do it before the 2018 election. So I think this is a bit of a wake-up call, and we understand that we have a messaging problem in talking about what we've accomplished because a lot of people just don't know.
Jamal, you got about 20 seconds.
Well, the messaging problem is they got a president who seems to continuously come out for things that seem racist and misogynistic. And I think Americans have basically decided, most Americans that we're seeing in elections, Alabama, we saw it in Virginia, saw it in New Jersey. Most Americans are saying they want an America that is inclusive, that embraces all of us. And then we can argue about how we do that. But the president and his wing of the party seem to want America where white males are the primary beneficiary.
Out of time. We only have time to say the president does not wear dentures. Sudafed was to blame for his slurring. We found that out from his medical report yesterday. Jamal Simmons, the Democratic strategist. John Brabender, the Republican strategist. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today in Cairo, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas blasted President Trump in a fiery speech, calling Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel sinful and ill-fated. And the criticism came as Vice President Mike Pence gets ready to leave on a Middle East trip. Abbas canceled his scheduled meeting with Pence after the Jerusalem decision, so the vice president will not be visiting the West Bank, but he will meet the leaders of Egypt, Jordan, and Israel. Jeremy Bowen is the BBC's Middle East editor. He joins us from London. And Jeremy, in his speech today, Abbas also said the Jerusalem decision has disqualified the U.S. from its role as a broker in the peace process, a role the U.S. has played for decades. Now, we've heard that thinking before, but is there a peace process even going on right now?
No, there isn't really, and there hasn't been for a long time. There's been talk of trying to get something new going under the Trump administration. But I'd say the last U.S. administration that really tried hard to get something going was President Obama and also his Secretary of State, John Kerry. Kerry particularly tried very hard, and then in the end it wasn't going to happen, and he made some very frustrated remarks about the way that the Israelis have made it very difficult for him.
Yeah, well, and the Palestinians, I mean, what leverage do they have?
None, really. The only leverage I suppose they have is moral, insofar as there are people, and there are a lot of people who disagree with this, but there are people who believe that the Palestinians had been victims of one of the great injustices of modern times. I have to, you know, emphasize that that's quite a controversial point of view among friends of Israel. Mm-hmm. But amongst Palestinians and their friends, that's taken for granted.
And are they seen as having even less leverage than the no leverage that they might have had before? Because now they don't even appear to have the United States, you know, with their interests at heart.
Well, the United States has presented itself over many years now as an honest broker. But that's something I would say that the Trump administration has really let go of. The decision taken back in December, or rather announced back in December, for the United States to essentially to buy into the Israeli view about who should be in charge in Jerusalem. In other words, that it should be all an Israeli-run city. Now, that's something which has been enormously controversial, not just among Palestinians and others, but really right around the world, here in Europe, enormously so. Mm. So the U.S. at the moment is, as Mahmoud Abbas said in his latest speech, the U.S. is absolutely not seen as an honest broker, an honest intermediary in any of this.
Okay, so to the trip that Vice President Pence is making, what role do Egypt and Jordan play in this story, the way it's playing out right now?
Well, Egypt and Jordan are really important players in all of this. You know, they're not players that can say this is what's going to happen. But in terms of the states that border Israel, there's no one more important than that. So the Egyptians particularly have had a lot of diplomatic work that they've been doing with the Palestinians, trying to promote the idea of Palestinian unity, a rapprochement between Fatah, which is the faction which is headed by President Mahmoud Abbas, and Hamas, the faction that's in Gaza. As for the Jordanians see themselves as the custodian of the Muslim holy sites in Jerusalem. They are very important in terms of their influence, actually on both sides, because the other thing too, for Jordan and for Egypt, is that both those countries have made peace treaties with Israel. And even though Mr. Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, and Israel's friends, you know, not least in the United States, are very good at, you know, making loud noises and bluffing and blustering. The fact is that from Israel's point of view, having peace with those two frontline countries has been enormously valuable.
Well, and what about the role of Vice President Pence, evangelical Christian? How does that interact in this story?
Now, I don't know precisely where Vice President Pence is in terms of his view of Zionism, his view of Israel, his view of the Palestinians. But, you know, frankly, he'll be seen there by all sides, actually, not so much as a religious man, but more as somebody who is the representative of the United States and of President Trump. And they will, of course, be wondering exactly which way President Trump is going to lean on any given issue at any given time.
Well, but they already know about Jerusalem, and that signals quite a bit. What has that done for Netanyahu?
Well, he was like the cat who's got the cream, because for him, this was a victory day, a very, very important day as far as he's concerned. And I think the Palestinians recognized it as a blow, which is why they were so angry and why they're still reeling as a result of it.
Well, and then Netanyahu ran into a little scandal. I'm not sure how this is playing out in Israel, so we wanted to ask you. It involves his son and the son of an Israeli gas tycoon. They were recorded in a car in 2015, a tape that just came out, and a government car going to strip clubs, fighting over the money that was spent. And Netanyahu's son argues, well, his father got a big gas deal that benefited the gas tycoon, the father of the other boy. How much has that revelation, or at least allegation, how much has that hurt?
Netanyahu was already under an awful lot of pressure because of various police investigations to do with corruption, which are progressing and which he says aren't going to go anywhere. But the fact is they're not going away. But, you know, it's when your dad is the Prime Minister of Israel and under a serious police investigation for corruption, and then when your son, who allegedly also works for him, when his son says to the son of the gas tycoon, bro, my dad now arranged a $20 billion show for you and you can't spot me 400 shekels. That's about $115. It's, at the very least, it's rather embarrassing. It shows him as a spoiled, overprivileged young man. It's been in all the papers. And, you know, you'd think that the pictures of Yair Netanyahu himself say it all. He really looks very, very downcast. He realizes he's done something really dumb.
Yeah. Go to your room.
BBC
Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen in London. Jeremy, thank you.
All right. Cheers. Thank you.
Well, as U.S. military operations continue in Afghanistan, Iraq, and several African countries, you may be surprised to hear that fewer than 1% of Americans are currently on active duty in the military, and that is contributing to a divide between those who serve and those who don't. Carson Frame reports from Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
Veterans of Foreign Wars Post 76 sits on a bend in San Antonio's famed Riverwalk. On weekday nights, its canteen draws a crowd of mostly veterans and active duty military, with a few civilians mixed in. Army veteran Anthony Sadler has been a member here for about 2 years, and this evening he's sitting on the patio smoking a cigarette. Sadler was deployed twice during his 30-year military career, once to Abu Ghraib prison. He's seen a lot.
I had a soldier that got shot, and I ran to get him, and right in front of me, he just gave up the ghost, you know, and so we're not used to that. As human beings, we're not prepared.
Sadler has civilian friends through church, but spends most of his time around people with a military background. The VFW is a place where he says he can be emotionally vulnerable, unlike at civilian bars.
If you went to another bar or downtown or a club, you couldn't share your feelings about military. And if you cry, then people, especially men, would take it as a weakness and they wouldn't understand what brought that emotion. You know, but people here, we totally get it.
Sadler's experience, preferring the company of other veterans, may reflect a larger phenomenon. Edelman Intelligence, a public relations firm, has been studying how veterans are perceived by the general population. Elisa Vitallo led the 2017 study, which found that fewer than 26% of people believe they have a lot in common with veterans.
I think that there is a perception that veterans have experiences that average citizens simply don't understand or can't understand.
From that disconnect springs a well of misperceptions. In the study, non-veterans often underestimated the education levels of their veteran counterparts or believed that they were less likely to seek care for mental health problems. That's making it harder for veterans to get jobs, says Vitello.
You know, our hypothesis here is that if this chasm between veterans and non-veterans is so wide socially, they're at that disadvantage in forming those connections when trying to get employment.
To improve veterans' job prospects, the Edelman study says, non-veterans and employers need a better understanding of who veterans are and what they bring to organizations and communities. But that's not easy. The Defense Department has consolidated military bases across the country, making it less likely that civilian and military communities overlap. After the U.S. transitioned to an all-volunteer military force in 1973, the burdens of war started falling on fewer shoulders. Admiral Mike Mullen, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says he's concerned that the military is becoming its own separate class.
Most American families aren't connected to the military, don't have kids that are in the military, don't have friends who have kids who are in the military. I liken it to, you know, and this is a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's almost like the French Foreign Legion.
In spite of all this, Elisa Vitello from the Edelman study says bridging the gap between the military and civilian worlds is simple, at least in principle.
Having a beer with a veteran, quite frankly, and making those one-on-one relationships is ultimately the way we're going to move beyond these misperceptions.
John Ornelas, the commander of VFW Post 76, agrees. He says he doesn't think that civilians can ever fully understand what he went through as a soldier in Vietnam, but he wishes they would try anyway.
I wish more of them did, and they would come here and talk to us and understand, you know, what we went through, what we're going through, and how we feel and so forth, because they don't ask.
But until civilians do start asking, veterans at the VFW seem content to share a few drinks among themselves. For Here and Now, I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
This podcast and following message sponsored by WBUR.
Hi, I'm Ben Brock Johnson, here to introduce you to Endless Thread, a new podcast from WBUR and Reddit featuring stories that capture the internet's endless permutations of human potential.
Even though it's like this huge network with millions of users, you know, there's still that kind of like small world connection there.
Endless Thread, supported by ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire, and by Wistia, where videos get put to work. Learn more at wbur.org/endlessthread and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the country's biggest banks, Citigroup, says it is giving raises to women and minorities who work at the company after an internal survey found a slight difference in pay between women and men and between minorities and white workers. The difference was only around 1%, less than the pay gap in many other industries. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake and joins us now. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy.
And is that really true that Citi already pays its minority workers and female workers 99% of what it pays its white male workers?
Well, I think we have to take them on face value. But I think it's also fair to say that they saw this coming and they've been doing a lot of hard work to get that up to that number of 1%.
Were employees speaking up there asking for raises, though?
You know, I think that we don't know for sure. I'm sure some were. I don't know if it was universally at the level that you might expect. But, you know, it's hard to ask for a raise when you don't know what your colleagues are making, right? And in the case of women, I think that we know that many of them are paid less right from day one. So as an individual, you may be getting pay raises every year and feeling pretty good about them until you find out that the person you're working next to, who may be male, doing a very similar, if not same job, is making a lot more than you. Then suddenly that raise doesn't feel very good. So that's why this push for transparency is so important. It has been something that so many have been fighting for. So we can all make a decision about whether you feel your compensation is appropriate.
Do we have any sense of what the discrepancy is elsewhere at other banks or other places in the industry?
We don't yet. I think we're going to get an idea, and I'm interested to see if they can match up with Citi, whether they've been working hard on this too, and if it's the more commercial banks like Citi, or if the investment houses have a bigger gap. But, you know, I think that I spoke to Natasha Lamb today, who works for Arjuna Capital, has been pushing this from a shareholder perspective. And she thinks that now that Citi has made this transparent, others will have to follow. But it's important. Pay matters a lot. And it's good to see that gap closing. But rank matters, too. And even in places like Citi, where the gap is 1%, when it comes to executive level, half the employees are women. Only 25% are in management jobs. And when you look at minorities, 11% of bank employees, African-American, less than 2% executives. So pay matters, but we have a lot more work to do in getting people up into those management positions and in the C-suite positions.
And what about more broadly across the economy? Where do these pay gaps stand between women and men, or whites and minorities, outside of the financial industry?
We're lagging, absolutely. I mean, you know, the numbers you still hear are women are about, you know, 80 cents on the dollar for what every man makes. Some industries are better. But one of the shocking things, and the data lags a little bit, reliable data, it always does by a few years, is that it's almost every industry. Even in industries where, you know, there are a lot more women, it's, say, healthcare springs to mind, right? Nurses, if you've been in a hospital lately, males still make more. So there's a lot of work to be done. But I have to tell you, and I was talking to Natasha about this today, now, there have been a lot of people pushing for this for a long time, as you know. But now that you, in the wake of Me Too and Time's Up, public opinion has changed. And in the case of Citi today, yes, they were facing regulations in the UK. They were probably going to have to do this anyway. But the idea of not being transparent, of not paying the same, is suddenly unpopular, and it looks bad for the brand. So there's a lot of forces now coming together to not only push for transparency, but I would also say push companies to do the right thing and close the gap. And they're also talent.
Yeah.
You know, there's a labor shortage, and so it's to retain the kind of talent they want. And Citi said this, they're having to close that gap as well.
Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Now let's check in with another Olympian ahead of the Winter Games. Today, figure skater Adam Rippon.
Artistically, there's something so special. It comes from experience of being able to wait for the music to take you. He's not rushing through this.
He is a beautiful, lyrical skater, but he barely made it to this, his first Olympics. He had a tough free skate, but his body of work propelled him to the team with Nathan Chen and Vincent Cho. That's how skating works. At 28, he's the oldest U.S. figure skating Olympic rookie since 1936. He also was the first openly gay man chosen to represent the U.S. in the Winter Games. Adam Rippon, congratulations, but it was close. You didn't initially qualify because of that free skate, under-rotating a quad, falling on another. What were you thinking?
When I got off of the ice of my free program, I only could think about what I had done over the past few years. I qualified for two Grand Prix finals. I was a U.S. champion. And the whole season, I had been skating very well and had really great scores. And I just had these demons from this national championships because I failed to qualify in 2010, and then I failed to qualify again in 2014. And then in the free skate, I just had this feeling like, oh my God, I'm going to mess up again. And I was very fortunate that the Olympic committee oversaw that last skate, and I was still the second man added to the team.
Because the U.S. Olympic team has this protocol set up, you know, a year ago, where they take into consideration the whole body of work. And even though your friend Ross Miner had a beautiful skate, you replaced him. But what you said was so fascinating. Just a few seconds of taking your head out of the performance, I mean, that's treacherous for an Olympian.
Oh, absolutely. And I know that. But, you know, I was so worried that I would just get so close and not make it again. It's just this bad idea that we just can't shake.
How does that go with your friend Ross Miner? You now replace him.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation. We've been friends for a very long time. But we had done an international about 3 years ago. I was third and he was fourth. And the referee said we had like a technical glitch. And the scores are reversed.
Huh. So there's some karma here. You've been here before.
Yeah, we have been here before. And you know what? I'm really fortunate that they looked at my whole body of work, you know, decided to add me, because I feel really ready for this moment. And I feel, honestly, Robin, I feel like I dropped like 4,000 pounds having this one competition out of the way.
Well, and, you know, there's some things that we need to talk about when it comes to you, Adam Rippon, because you bring other things to this sport. I'm referring, of course, to the fact that you're 28, which is considered ancient. You know, you've got much younger skaters going with you. Talk about being 28 and being considered, you know, a miracle that you're still skating.
Well, you know, my two teammates are 17 and 18. and I think that in figure skating and in sports in general, that, you know, when you're young, it's considered a huge advantage because you're fearless. And you also don't have bad past experiences. Like, you know, I've tried to qualify for an Olympic team for 3 times now. And, you know, when you're 17, that's just not possible. Like,
so you're saying that you understand at 17 you might not make it. But as you get older, you realize you're running out of time.
Yes. You see that you're like, time is fleeting. But with age comes experience, and I have found that my experience is a huge advantage to me as a competitor.
Also, the only openly gay man in the Olympics from the U.S. You've talked about growing up in Scranton, PA, being smaller than other people, being somewhat bullied, and finding in skating, figure skating, the expressions that you wanted to make that you were repressing elsewhere, they were accepted.
You know, when I found skating, it was something that was individual, and it was something that I could focus on being my best. And I loved the whole practice, and I also loved performing. Mm-hmm. It was probably the first time I felt really good about myself and that I was good at something, because I always liked being athletic. I enjoyed playing the other sports. I just sucked at them.
But not skating. We should give a shout out to your coach, Rafael Rutunian.
Yes.
Because skating is expensive and it's hard for most families to afford. He helped you with your car lease. So a lot of people supported you along the way. But have I got this right that you couldn't really be the skater that you've become until you could fully be the person that you are, until you came out?
I had to become a fully evolved person before I think I would be ready to go to the Olympic Games. And I got to a point where I was like, you know what, I need to kind of take on this responsibility. And I was, you know, in my really early 20s. And I told my mom, I was like, you know what, Mom, if I can't pay for this myself, I don't want to do it. And, you know, there were a lot of days where I was a member of a gym and I just would have no money to my name, that I would like take all of the Granny Smith apples that they had in like the locker room, and I'd be like, okay, this is like lunch and dinner. But it made me really strong, and from that strength I had sort of, I think at the time it felt like I needed to have a little courage to come out and share my story, because I remember when I was young and didn't really know who I was, I would read about those coming out stories, and they made a world of difference to me. And I said, if I ever have the chance, I want to share my story as well. And when I did that, that's really kind of when my skating career really took off.
And your tweets are just fantastic.
Thanks.
You tweet out things like, while you may not be shocked that I am gay, surprise, I hope it helps a young girl or boy who doesn't feel like they belong, like I once did, you know, in Scranton. But have you ever talked to Brian Boitano or Johnny Weir, who did not come out until after their Olympic careers?
You know, I do know them personally, and know Brian very well. But, you know, it's a different time. I remember when I told my mom that I wanted to come out, and my mom was a little hesitant. She was saying, are you sure? Do you think that it might, you know, affect your scores, or Is it something that you think that you need to do? And I told her, I was like, I don't care. It's important to me, because at the same time, it gave my skating a greater purpose than it was just for me. And I just said, you know what, I'm at a point now where I'm doing well, and I want to show that you can be successful and an out athlete, and it really doesn't matter.
You do open yourself up to a little bit of trolling, and yet you have knocked that back. And we should say, you know, after that decision to come out, you didn't come in second in 2016. You won it. So
I did, yeah.
Seemed to be validating your decision. Adam Rippon, one of three U.S. men's single-figure skaters headed to the Olympics next month. Quick question. What do you think about Yusuro Hanyu from Japan? This, you know, he's called the Michael Jackson of figure skating. He always has his Winnie the Pooh bear and a huge cult following. I mean, who are you looking at on the ice? Or do you not think of the other countries? What's your thinking there?
As a competitor, I look around and I want to see what my competitors are doing so that I can go out there and I can put my best performance out there. But I think when I have my most success, I am not looking around. And I'm just kind of focused on what I need to do to get my job done. And, you know, I know I might not be the best, but I have that feeling that I am the best. Even if at times I don't believe it, or if I look around and I don't think anyone else believes it, I tell myself that it's real. And it just gives me a little bit of that extra fire when I'm on the ice during a performance.
Hmm. I was going to ask you what you think about, like, for instance, during your free skate, but instead of thinking those, you know, demon thoughts, is that what you're thinking? I'm the best, or this is wonderful?
I am so quiet. My mind is so quiet when I'm out on the ice, and it's just very methodical, and I try to stay in the very present moment.
We will be there with you. Adam Rippon, one of three U.S. men's singles figure skaters headed to the Olympics. Adam, thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Legal sales of recreational pot got started earlier this month in California despite a growing number of legal questions. The Justice Department recently scaled back a policy that had allowed legal marijuana users to avoid federal prosecution. And there's still no legal standard for how much marijuana you can have in your system when you're behind the wheel of a car. That's a big issue for the eight states and the District of Columbia that have legalized recreational pot use. Eli Wertschafter from member station KALW reports on an emerging industry trying to figure out how to test if someone is too high to drive.
My friend Meg Schwarzman used to bike through this intersection in Berkeley, California, almost every day.
We're at the corner of Bancroft and Fulton.
And then 2 years ago, she was in a crash here that almost killed her. She had an 11-month-old baby at home, so she was an extra careful biker. She was wearing a Dayglow green jacket and a new helmet.
So this intersection is where I was hit. The driver was behind me and he ran over me from behind, trapping me under the car and dragging me 60 feet across the intersection.
The driver was a medical cannabis user. He told police he had smoked before getting in the car.
He actually was high enough he didn't know he'd hit me.
Firefighters pulled Meg out from under the car just in time to save her life. Her injuries included 20 broken ribs, 2 collapsed lungs, and skull fractures around her left eye and cheek.
They'd called in the fatal accident investigation team. They didn't expect me to survive.
Meg recovered completely, but she's worried that now that marijuana is legalized, there will be more stoned drivers on the road.
We have some deterrence with alcohol in that we have breathalyzer tests and legal consequences. And there are legal consequences for driving high also, but there aren't good tests for it.
In California, the consequences for driving drunk and driving high are the same. But while there's a clear blood limit for alcohol, there's no such standard for marijuana.
Marijuana is very different than alcohol.
This is Jolene Foreman, a lawyer with the Drug Policy Alliance.
With alcohol, there's a very clear correlation between the amount of drinks you have and your gender and body weight and what your level of impairment is.
When you drink a glass of wine, the alcohol shows up in your blood and in your brain. As its effects wear off, alcohol disappears from your brain and your blood, too.
Marijuana works totally differently, where it can stay in your blood for days, and even weeks after you've consumed it.
Besides that, THC, the psychoactive chemical in marijuana, can affect people really differently.
There's no clear correlation between THC levels in the blood and driving impairment.
So unlike some other states, California chose not to set a THC limit for drivers. Instead, police here look for signs like poor balance and dilated pupils. The State Highway Patrol says those sobriety tests are an effective way to catch impaired drivers.
But it's often challenging without objective data to arrest the person and then prosecute them down the line.
This is Mike Lynn. He stepped back from his old job as an ER doctor to focus on a new project.
This is our Hound Labs marijuana breathalyzer.
Lynn co-founded a company in Oakland called Hound Labs. They've developed a breathalyzer that he says can measure both alcohol and THC. It kind of looks like a black plastic tape dispenser with a tube sticking out.
And you blow through that tube, it'll make a noise telling you that you're blowing properly.
THC in breath comes in tiny concentrations, parts per trillion. It's hard to detect, and there isn't much published research yet. But Lynn says, unlike with blood, THC stays in breath only a few hours.
Why that is, nobody really knows. We just know that when you have THC in your breath, you've used pot very, very recently, and you're much more likely to be impaired.
The Hound Labs test doesn't prove someone's intoxicated, but it could still serve as evidence someone used cannabis recently. Hound Labs hopes to sell the breathalyzer to police departments starting this year.
We're contacted by departments all over the country, and frankly, multiple countries outside the U.S. as well.
Hound Labs has raised $14 million from investors, and other companies are marketing different THC tests for saliva and even sweat on your fingertips. But some cannabis advocates say any chemical test is the wrong way to go. Dale Geringer is the head of California Normal, an advocacy group for the reform of marijuana laws.
You might have it on your breath, but does that mean that you're actually impaired?
Geringer says we need a way to measure if you're really safe to drive, not just if there's a chemical in your system.
I actually have an app to do it in my pocket here.
He opens up an app called My Canary.
Okay, so here it is, all right?
It asks him to remember a series of numbers and then do a balancing test.
Cross my arms in front of my body like King Tut, then raise my dominant foot.
Federal records show that car crashes related to drug use have risen sharply in recent years. In 2015, 43% of drivers in fatal crashes were found to have drugs in their system. That includes marijuana, opioids, and other drugs besides alcohol.
Marijuana is not the only drug out on the road. I think we really need to focus on are people impaired or not, and if they're impaired, we should get them off the road.
Geringer says computerized tests could give an objective measure of drivers' mental and physical state, no matter what drugs they've used. For Here and Now, I'm Eli Wirtschafter.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now,